The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, hello, everyone. And I'm going to try to talk about the topic of right relationships and how I'm using this term is in the same way that the word right is used for in the Eightfold Path. So right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right way of life, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And in fact, one way of looking at the Eightfold Path, all eight of those factors are defining or bringing forth right relationship. That's what the Eightfold Path is about. And the word right is, some people have problematic with it in English because it just seems like maybe it's righteous or if it's, you know, some kind of moralistic right that you have to be a certain way. The word samma in the ancient language, samyak in Sanskrit, is the first definition in the dictionary, in Pali English dictionary, is thorough. And in Sanskrit, it's, I don't know if it's first, but it includes definition of being full or complete. So the intention, the view, the relationships that are complete or full is part of the meaning. And so what would it like for a relationship to be complete, to be whole, is part of this question. In being part of the Eightfold Path, it also the word samma also has the, apparently the etymology of it, it goes back maybe before the Buddha's time, has also the meaning of to incline towards, to move towards, like a, be directed towards a particular direction. And so the complete, in the kind of completely involved in a particular direction. And the direction is towards liberation, towards freedom. And this freedom that Buddhism talks about is very relational in a certain way, and a certain way is trans-relational, maybe, or, you know, free of relatedness. And this wonderful kind of richness of the combination of both is part of this fascinating way in which the Dharma practice deepens. So the way that the Eightfold Path can be seen as being relational is that the first right view has to do with seeing suffering and seeing what, how suffering comes to be. Sometimes it's seeing the cause, sometimes seeing the dynamics of how it appears. And and suffering is always relational, the suffering that we're looking about. It has to do with the way that we relate to things in the world and to others. And sometimes it, when suffering is, we've caused, harm's been caused to us, it's because someone's in relationship to us or the world's in relationship to us in such a way that there's harm caused. But in a strict sense, in Buddhism, when they use the word suffering, they there's a very personal contribution that goes into that. That we want to take into account. And one of the contributions is that there's clinging, there's attachment to that. And so, and to be attached to anything is to be in relationship to that thing. To be attached to anything, you're not free of it. You're kind of entangled or caught in it. And if you can become free of it, that gives the opportunity for us to be related to it, to have a relationship that's very different. And so there's no, there might be no intentional relationship to it in terms of wanting something or intending something. When a person's free, then their goodwill, their love, their compassion can flow, and that contributes to whatever they relate to, whatever it might be. And when you're free, you're not being defined by the relationship. When you're not free, we tend to be defined or shaped or limited by the relationship because of the attachments, or what we want or what we don't want or what we're resisting and all these things. So right view has to do with understanding that. right intention, the second factor of the Eightfold Path, is clearly relational. The right view is, one way of understanding it is that is to relate to things with compassion, to relate to things with kindness, and relate to things with a very dangerous word in English concept, with renunciation. So it's nice to be challenged by these big words. But the simple way of saying it is to relate to things without projecting our clinging on it, our attachment on it. And the renunciation the Buddha always focuses on is not renunciation of things, but a relationship to our clinging attachment to things. So it's a different relationship, with or without clinging. Right speech is completely relational, right? Usually we speak to ourselves, relating to ourselves perhaps, but when we speak out loud, it's usually to other people. And so we're in relationship with them, and what comes through the speech, how we're relating, what's being created there, what's being done there. And right speech is speech which is kind, timely, truthful, beneficial. So really, you have to looking at the relationship and what's kind, what's beneficial for what's happening here. Right action is usually understood to be avoid three actions, which you'll understand are very relational. One is killing someone, the other is stealing from someone, and the third is engaging in sexual misconduct with someone. So that's very relational, right? And so as we develop the Eightfold Path, those areas of our relatedness to others begins to shift. And perhaps rather than having those three awful things happen, it's the opposite that begins happening. There's a reverence for life. There's a tremendous generosity in not taking but giving. And there's a deep respect for people and their sexual well-being and all that entails. And then there's right livelihood or right living, which tends to be, for most people, is very related to something, if not to other people. If you're a subsistence farmer living by yourself, you're still relating to the world and to the land there. And some of the most beautiful relatedness to the world sometimes is for people who are farming in some kind of harmony with the natural world. I read a wonderful New York Times article this last week about maybe it was titled something like "A Truce in the War," and it was the war that farmers, I think it might have been in Colorado or in someplace, Arizona, that they had with beavers, ranchers with beavers, and they in order to, because they felt that these beavers are causing too much problems, they would blow up the beaver dams. And then this man inherited his father's farm, and he thought there's another way. And he started to allow the beavers to build their dams. And then he kind of worked with them a little bit. Sometimes he needed to help drain the water, and he put pipes in, but didn't destroy the dams. And what happened was that his farm, his ranch, became much more resilient in times of drought and in times of flooding. The dams, turns out, protected the land tremendously and protected the moisture in the land tremendously. And so now there's a lot of movement for ranchers to work with the beavers rather than getting rid of them. So this idea of being in how we live our life in relationship to the world, what kind of relationship are we living there? And then right effort could be seen as a relationship. Right effort is mostly very personal, though it has a relational effect, but it has a lot to do with your relationship to yourself. And so to really understand in yourself what motivates, what engages you with activity in the world, in yourself. And so to have a mind, mental activity, that avoids what is unhealthy mental actions and mental activities and do those things which are healthy. And so it means tracking yourself, being mindful of what's going on. Right mindfulness is maybe a little bit harder to find exactly the which way, but it's the foundation for allows us to be in relationship to the world in a good way. And right concentration is a phenomenally beautiful way to be related to oneself. It's probably one of the most beautiful ways to relate to yourself, to set up this kind of inner life, to be really settled and deeply concentrated, relaxed, and allowing the natural kind of flow of energy within us to kind of flow in a harmonious way. It's a beautiful thing. So the Eightfold Path, so the totality of the old Eightfold Path, maybe we can call right relationship. And what is the relationship? And some of you know that sometimes there's a category that's, they say there's three things. There's you, there's you, there's others, and there's the we that exists between them. Me, you, and we. But we is a little bit of a maybe abstract idea. And so I like to say that there's me, you, and the relationship between us. And sometimes we need to take care of that relationship more than we need to take care of the other person, more than we need to take care of oneself. I saw this very clearly as I started to have children, and I have two sons. And when they were young, it became clear at some point, in a way I hadn't known before, that because my wife, maybe speak myself especially, I'd done a lot of letting go, and the study of compassion and caring, and so it was like, just let's take care of this kid, at all costs, whatever is needed. And my mother would tell me, careful, you don't spoil him. And that didn't mean anything for me. I just ignored her. And later I understood, if she'd only used it, maybe a different word. She actually was good advice. But what happened, I realized after a while that it didn't really make sense as a child. When the child was, a month old, of course you sacrifice everything for the kid. He can't do anything for himself. But as they get older and older, you have to pull back and let them kind of more autonomy. But also became clear as my son got, and my sons got older, there was a we, there was a family unit. And unless we took care of the family unit, we were going to create a skewed relationship in the family. And my son wasn't going to learn how to live in harmony with the family unit. It wasn't all about his welfare and what he wanted, right? That's the recipe for disaster. But he had to also learn that other people had need and the family had need. And so I think just in time we got some sense of that. And so the we became very important, the family unit. And so that's true, for when there's two people involved or a family involved. It's true when there's a sangha involved, a community involved, a town, a city, a nation, a world, that there's also the we of everyone. And how does that, what's the relationship of that? And what's happening there? And what are we contributing to that relationship? And to focus a little bit on the relationship is unusual for some people. There are some people for whom what they focus on is me, myself, and mine. Everything is seen through the filter of how this affects me, what I want, what I don't want, how this is impacting me, and how I'm being hurt by this, how I'm a victim for this, and how I'm afraid of everything or something. It's all about me. And there's powerful conditioning forces in our society that really inculcate this kind of view. It's not something we create by ourselves. This whole focus on me, me, me that can exist is something that's been, some people have been kind of trained by our society. I mean, like I said, in my family, I could see if we weren't careful at some point, that's what we were creating in our son. And our society, with so many different forces, is reinforcing self-preoccupation, self-concern, in it for yourself, all kinds of things. And so that's some people's default. And it's so strongly in our culture that people don't even know they're doing it. And they're so strong in our culture that it's like second nature for people to be self-concerned, and it's about me, and don't even know, they don't even recognize they're thinking that way. It's just obvious, and it's obvious you're supposed to share yourself, in some way, that me, it's about me in a way. And then some people are the opposite. It's all about the others. Like, it can be for young parents like me who are kind of naive, not knowing, and just kind of give everything. It's all about that person. And And some people have religious and family kind of worldviews that really reinforce it's about others, taking care of them. But what is about that third thing, that in the relationship? And what happens in that relationship? How do we study it? How do we see it? And it's not something we see physically. And this is now we're kind of entering into, you know, a little bit the invisible world. Not like a mystical invisible world or something or the other, but it's something we don't obviously see. You have to be attuned to. You have to pay attention. You have to pick up the cues. You have to understand yourself better in order to really understand what's happening here in the relationship to this. But that also makes it kind of fun. And it's a very different way of navigating in the world, surfing along the relatedness rather than engaging this world by asserting oneself or denying oneself. And the example that I have for you that, it's not going to work for many of you because many of you probably haven't gone surfing. I think it's possible I haven't really tried surfing more than once. So I don't know what I'm talking about, maybe. So, but maybe you'll forgive me and allow just use this as an example, and hopefully it can. If you're on a surfboard and you're able to catch that wave, you don't catch it, and you're on the wave, and okay, I've done it. Now I can just freeze and just kind of ride the wave out and not do anything anymore. But the wave is dynamic, and you're dynamic, and everything is dynamic. And so you have to be totally in, kind of in harmony in relationship to all the different factors at play and shifting and adjusting accordingly the whole time. And probably one of the reasons it's so fun to be on a surfboard is that self-concern drops away. Self-preoccupation, self-consciousness drops away because you have to be so fully engaged to be right in the present moment to track all the different things going on. And it's not just the wave, but it's all, everything that's involved, including you. And if there are two different people riding exactly the same wave, and one person is really petite and one person is humongous, the size, whatever, they're probably going to ride the wave very differently. And they might follow the wave just as far, the same distance. So both of them are managing to do the wave perfectly, but it's going to look very different for these two people. And so the perfect way to ride that wave is going to be different for those two people. And it has to do with the relatedness between what the factors that the individual brings and the factors of the board. You know, they have different size boards, and it depends what board you have. Probably the same person riding the same wave on different boards, switching boards every time. The perfect riding the wave is different because it all depends on the board, too. So the person who's riding doing the perfect ride is in constant conversation, relatedness, with that, contributing that relationship, so to stay on the board, but also recognizing what the wave is contributing, what the board is contributing, the whole thing. And so it's a dynamic thing. And it's the combination of all the relatedness, all those things coming together that allows us to do the perfect ride. So for you living your life, what's the perfect life? What's the perfect way to do things? What's the perfect way to be in a conversation with someone? What's the perfect way of caring for someone? Or what's the perfect way of doing anything? If you carry an external standard of what that is, I'm supposed to be like someone else, that's the way they do it, it's not going to be it. The perfect way to be, or in the language of samma, right, the complete way to be, the whole way of being, in relationship to this situation, has to do with your contributions and who you are and all kinds of things about you as much as it has to do with the situation. So I train people to do spiritual caregiving as chaplains, and I say, tell that these people being trained sometimes that if you're a maybe I usually say unrepentant extrovert, but maybe that's not a good way of saying it. And then I follow that by unrepentant introvert. But what I mean by that is you're completely at home with being who you are. You don't have to apologize. You don't have to, you know, it's not a crime. So someone who is a very strong extrovert shows up to with someone who they're offering spiritual care to, like in a hospital. The right spiritual care relationship is found in that relationship between them. And so the person doing the spiritual care has to be attuned to not only the other person, but to themselves, to know where that right way of being is. And I knew one spiritual caregiver, a chaplain, who showed up to a very difficult situation and couldn't really communicate to this person who was conscious, but it was, you know, was had her face to the wall, wouldn't communicate to anyone, was pretty upset. And so the spiritual caregiver started singing Amazing Grace. If I sang Amazing Grace, I just would sing to my kids sometimes when they were little, and they'd tell me to stop. So, that wouldn't be my way. But that was that person's way. And if someone is this unrepented introvert, what their perfect spiritual caregiving conversation is going to be very different. Maybe for them, who they are and what's right, is maybe they should sit down quietly and hold someone's hand. And that's the avenue with which the perfect spiritual caregiving thing happens. So it's in the relationship between all the factors, not in some abstract idea that we have perfection. So this is very respectful of yourself. You get to be yourself. Imagine, just get to be yourself. But you have to know yourself well enough to know what you're contributing, and to know the situation well enough to know that you're contributing the right thing, and you're creating the right relationship in that interaction between them. And if what you're contributing is clinging, grasping, attachment, it's probably not going to be a good outcome. If what you're committing, bringing into it, is cruelty and unkindness, meanness, it's probably not a good relationship. It's not one that you're going to thrive in or is healthy for you and others. If it's wrong speech, if there's a lot of complaining and a lot of you're doing kind of verbal stabbing of people, verbal knives about, just kind of get backing at them. And you're establishing a certain relationship there. But if your words are kind, supportive, not mean, not cynical or complaining about something or blaming, very different relationship gets formed. And the sad thing is sometimes people want to have an unhealthy relationship. Sometimes because they think they get some benefit from it or something. So to be careful with this relatedness, the right relationship. What do we contribute to it? And one of the principles you find sometimes in Buddhism is the idea that to assert the self is delusion. But to allow all things to inform you is awakening. So to take the self, your self, it is, the key word is assertion, pushing yourself, asserting yourself aggressively, putting yourself up into the world, with clinging attachment. And that can be done forcefully, but it could also, oddly enough, in Buddhism, Buddhist terms, we assert ourselves in the world when we are really shy. That's just as much, even though it looks like we're pulling back and not doing something, there's still a strong sense of self that we're contributing to the situation. And so what we're learning in Buddhist practice is how to soften and relax all attachment, all clinging, so that we have an opportunity to come forward in a different way. And one of those attachments is this excessive preoccupation with self. That has been the case since the time of the Buddha, otherwise he wouldn't have been teaching this not-self or non-selfishness that he taught. But in probably every generation of things, it's gotten worse now. So maybe that's, you know, but, you know, it seems to me it's pretty bad. And it's still an issue. So to really understand the me, myself, and mine, and how much we're self-preoccupied and measuring things by the impact it has on us, of course we want to respect ourselves. We're definitely part of the riding the wave, right? But are you contributing a healthy relationship to yourself? And maybe we should not even use the language healthy relationship to yourself, because as soon as you use the word yourself, it's a magnet for all these cultural, familial, religious ideas of what it means to be a self that we're way down under. So another way of saying it may be a healthy relationship to all that lives within us, and free it from this idea of being the self that we have to prove or defend or do anything with. To be awakened is to be informed by all things. And so to be informed by what's within us, it's all to be respected. Every thought, every impulse, every feeling, every emotion in this practice is respected. We're in a healthy relationship to it. We don't condemn it, and we don't hold on to it. And oddly enough, we don't celebrate it. Maybe you don't get, nothing gets kind of overly evaluated, overly valued. Everything is respected, which allows for the birth of this healthy relatedness, this freedom in which things can flow. And the idea that things can flow within us without it being appropriated by self, made into self, measured by self, is a fascinating and delightful and empowering kind of situation to be in. And so to begin exploring this world of self, the selfing we do, the attachment to it, not in any blame, not in, now you're a bad Buddhist. You don't become a bad Buddhist by anything that you do and how you are. Maybe you're never a bad Buddhist. But where Buddhism is found and where the health is found is in the relationship we have with all things, including your relationship to yourself. And some of the relationships that people have with themselves, what's been going on here, is very difficult. There's a lot of criticism, sometimes despising oneself. There's a lot of difficulty here. And it's painful, very deep. And so trying to come to a new relationship, find a new relationship where there's compassion and care and kindness, it's a slow process. But it's helpful to know that this is what we're doing. We're trying to come to a new relatedness where we're freeing ourselves from the fixed ideas of who we are, fixed ideas of this is what perfect is or this is what imperfect is. There's no imperfect or perfect. Or if there is perfection riding the wave, perfect riding the wave, you know how long that lasts? It lasts probably less than a second. So congratulations. But you don't have any time to congratulate yourself because you're on to the next half seconds when you have to kind of make the adjustments for the next perfection. And so with this kind of idea, you know how long you're imperfect? A few of us are occasionally imperfect, right? A little bit, you know. But you know how long it really lasts? It's like the wave. It's like, it might be true for half a second. Unless we're caught in the idea of it. We're projecting the idea, we're living the idea, I'm imperfect. But the idea is just an idea. The idea of the wave is just the idea, but the wave is always changing. You're always changing. Everything is fluid. And one of the things we're coming to in this practice of mindfulness is appreciating deeper and deeper the fluidity of the moment to moment. We're always on a wave. We're always finding our way. And if you're not finding your way, you'll probably fall off. the wave in some ways. If you get involved in too much retrospective thinking about what I did, you probably fall off the wave. So to ride the wave of the present moment, and what is the right relationship? What is the way, what's the relationship that arises when it's informed by everything, within and without? And as we become freer, what we discover is that we don't have to be so self-concerned about how we respond. The sense of the right response, it's just, it becomes more and more, it feels almost natural, obvious. Of course you're going to be kind. Of course, or say differently, maybe you won't automatically be kind, but you'll automatically not be unkind. You won't be mean. You'll automatically become someone. This is, it's very clear in Buddhism, they say that once you reach a certain maturity in this practice, you become someone who will never kill intentionally, never steal, never engage in sexual misconduct that harms people. So there's all these ways in which, you know, you don't do all this stuff that's as harmful, because that takes work and effort. And with the absence of that, what is left? And what I love is this tradition, that where it's Buddhist tradition that we're in, it doesn't specify what's left. It's very reluctant to say that what's left is your basic human goodness. What's left is wonderful. What's left is love and delight and all that. Because as soon as you say that, you fall off the wave. As soon as you say that, you're kind of locked on to something, and this is how it has to be. But rather, there's a deep trust in with this maturity of just allowing something to flow through us now that you know is not going to be unhealthy, not going to be harmful. So that's taken out of the picture. And then what the response is from the inside might not look like the ideal, might not look what you think it's supposed to be. But maybe it's the right thing in the combination, the relatedness of you and everything else. Who knows what that's supposed to be? You don't even know what it's going to be sometimes. To come with preconceived ideas limits what might arise. So to assert the self is delusion. To allow all things to inform you, or allow all things to inform, allows for health to unfold, the healthy wave. So I'd encourage you, if this talk had some meaning for you, that I'm not assuming that what I was saying about the relationship between you and the world, you and others, is an obvious category to understand. Maybe because it's always shifting. I'm not saying it's easy, like now you can just kind of... But there is this relatedness. There is something that happens in relationship. And it takes a while to begin to become sensitive to it and attuned to it and appreciate it. And with some people it's easier, and some people it's not so easy. There might be good friends that you can say, there's a new thing I want to understand better. Maybe you can help me. There's not you, and there's me, and there's what happens between us. Let's explore that. And having some friend to help you might be make it kind of come alive more and interesting, and make it help you with this new kind of world. And maybe you'll understand at some point, very personally, to assert the self is delusion, and to allow everything to inform you is awakening. So, thank you.